How is America faring with the war on poverty? Did we lose the war in the 60s, as some have suggested? Did we even declare a war on poverty in the first place? And how has the welfare reform enacted by Bill Clinton in 1996 affected the fortunes of the millions of Americans who remain, even in this prosperous time, below the poverty line? During this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking with someone who has been on the front lines of the effort to address poverty in America since the 1960s. Peter Edelman was an aide to Senator Robert F. Kennedy from his campaign for the U.S. Senate until he was assassinated in 1968. Peter Edelman has held various posts in Washington, most recently as Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services during the Clinton administration. In 1996, he resigned that position in protest over Clinton's signing of the Welfare Reform Act, ending in Clinton's word, welfare as we know it. In 1997, Peter Edelman wrote a cover story for the Atlantic Monthly about that episode entitled "The Worst Thing Bill Clinton Has Done," and you may have seen that article. Still available on the web, by the way. A professor of law at Georgetown University, Peter Edelman has continued talking and writing about the problems of poverty in America and about the kinds of policies needed to effectively address it. He has also authored a book on the subject, which also covers his time with Robert Kennedy, entitled Searching for America's Heart, RFK and the Renewal of Hope, recently published by Houghton Mifflin. Peter Edelman gave a public lecture last night here in Champaign-Urbana, which was the 11th annual Daniel S. Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture on Poverty and Welfare Policy Challenges for the New Century. We're glad to have him here to talk with us about that during this hour. As we talk with Peter Edelman, you are welcome to join the conversation. The number around Champaign-Urbana to call, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL if you match the letters with the numbers. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states our signal travels, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Peter Edelman, good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you. Well, just to start the conversation, and we can talk about a lot of different aspects of this, but I could just kind of throw this out and see what you think. What has been the impact of the 1996 welfare reform bill?
It's mixed. It's not as bad as I thought it would be for a very simple reason. We've had an incredibly prosperous time in this country, fortunately, fortuitously, in relation to this, because people who were pushed to get off welfare have been able to go out and find jobs when before that they might not have been or in many times weren't available. So that's been the good news in all of this. But the bad news is that because these policies, they differ from state to state. They're not the same everywhere. And there's some states that really have tried to help people get off and stay off and make a better life for themselves, because nobody really likes welfare. The bad news is that there are too many places where people have been pushed off or can't get on when they go to apply, because there's no legal obligation anymore to help them. And so they end up not working, and they also don't have cash assistance. And that's a big number. The welfare rolls, you know, have gone down by over 50%. And, of course, that's what the proponents of how wonderful the law is tell us all the time. Oh, the welfare rolls have been cut in half. Well, you have to ask a few more questions. So the ones that don't have jobs and don't have welfare now are over 3 million people. About a million adults, over a million moms who really are worse off. And I think that's very troubling.
Well, what do we know about those people and their situation?
We don't know enough. It's hard to follow people who have disappeared in this way. I really call these people America's disappeared. Again, because of the hot economy, I think most of them have been able to move in with extended families. So you're not seeing 3 million people, 2 million children out in the streets. But the fact is that it's deeply troubling to me. The homeless shelters all over the country are absolutely packed. They're absolutely bursting at the seams. And there's another reason for this, which is another problem that we ought to be addressing, and that's the skyrocketing cost of rental housing. It's just amazing what's happened. It's, of course, a side effect of the boom of recent years. And that's made a lot of people who are technically not in poverty unable to both afford the rent and feed their family at the same time, and they end up homeless. But some of it is because a woman and her children have lost their welfare, haven't been able to find a job, and don't have anywhere to go, and they end up in the homeless shelters. There are also women, I think, who probably have done things they shouldn't have done because they were desperate. So it's a mix of things. And I worry that we seem to have a recession coming now, Jack, and people have moved in, moms have moved in with extended family where somebody did have a job, you know, and they could, somebody was putting soup on the table and they were thinning the soup, but somebody's going to lose that job maybe in those families. And so, and the time limits that are built into this welfare law are coming around the country and kind of hitting at the same, may hit at the same time here. So I'm, we already have a problem, but I'm really worried about having increasing problems here.
There's been a lot of discussion about the number of jobs created since 1996. And because the economy has been pretty robust, there have been a lot of jobs created and so forth. But what kind of jobs are they? And are they the kind of jobs that enable people to really, you know, those people who are on welfare to move up and to, you know, live the American dream, so to speak?
That's a serious concern. We have huge number of people who were on welfare who were working because we're talking about large numbers of people. So about 60% of those have gone who've gone off. That's the other story. I was talking about the 40% of those who've gone off who have nothing now. So people emphasize, well, 60% of those who went off are working. And yes, that's a good thing. It's not as big a number as I'd like to see. And then you have to ask that next question that you're asking, which is how well are they doing? Now, that's the beginning of a story that can be a good story because it's better to be working than not working. A whole lot of those people are only working part-time, but they're counted as employed. A lot of people get a job and lose it, and then they don't have support for a while, and they get another job. So the average wage of those 60% who are working, and that is about somewhere over 1.5 million people who've gotten jobs coming off welfare. That's about $7 an hour. It's average, which means a lot of them less. And the average amount of work they have is a little over 30 hours a week. This is national. These are national kind of composite numbers. It's easier to see what to do, except we haven't done it. You can add to their income. We can make the earned income tax credit, which we have on the books, better, especially for larger families. And we can do more with the child care assistance that people need and make it available to everybody who needs help because child care is very, very expensive, and we're not doing that yet. And we can get health care to the parents as well as the children, which is something that we should do. And we can help people with the cost of rental housing. And all of that would make these people more successful. It's really important to stop and say, why is it that we have in this really rich country so many lousy jobs? I mean, that's not something we can fix right away, but we ought to focus on it because there's something wrong when people are doing their very best, working as hard as they possibly can, and they're really still not able to make ends meet. And the poverty line, which is $14,000 for a family of three now, that's a kind of an artificial structure or construct, that's ridiculous, $14,000 for a family of three. You can earn a whole lot more than that and really, really not make it.
Well, you raised the question about the nature of these jobs and why it is that they don't offer more in the way of salary and livability and, you know, well, a living wage, as people are terming it. What has happened structurally that has led us down that path?
It goes back, really, I think, to the early 1970s. Big story of the economy, in some ways further than back than that, as we started to lose manufacturing jobs. They went abroad. They were destroyed by technology, automation, and they were replaced by less good jobs, by service jobs, jobs in the service economy that are basically minimum wage or minimum wage plus jobs. That's the basic story that's happened. So the poverty story in the 60s was really, you know, it was more racial than it is now, although there's still a racial aspect to it because people of color, African American, Latino, do less well. They're poor at higher rates still, and that's a serious problem. But the poverty story has become much more related to work. 70% of kids who are poor live in families where there's some income from work. And in fact, probably a quarter of kids who are poor live in a family where there's somebody working full time and they can't get out of poverty. So it's because of the structural changes in the economy, and we have all of these jobs that one way or another, it's like a two-tier economy. There's the people who are making the big bucks, and then there's the people who do service in one way or another, working in hotels and restaurants and retail places and who are really serving the rest of the population. And I don't mean to say that we can just decree to those employers tomorrow that they could pay a whole lot more, because they can't afford to. The way we've structured things, we could raise the minimum wage some. We should. At least a dollar right now will not destroy jobs and would not even get us back to where the minimum wage was in real terms back in about 1970. But we need to say, okay, the reality is people are doing their very best. They're not making it. And we've got to figure out what to do to get some help to all of them, not just people who've been on welfare. Welfare is a small subset of the issue. Poverty really isn't even the whole issue. It's about the millions of people in this country who are having a very tough time. It's fairness.
We started talking about the 1996 Welfare Reform Act and the fact that you resigned in protest over Bill Clinton's signing of that act. I wonder if you can talk about your thinking about that. What was it about the bill, about the change that was made in the welfare system that so moved you that you left your position with the government?
Basically, two things. Boiling down to one, it destroyed a flawed system which needed to be reformed.
Yes.
It's not that I can say I hated the old system. I thought it was just awful. It didn't get people out of poverty, didn't get people jobs, didn't really protect children. Recipients hated it. The taxpayers hated it. We needed to really fix it so that it was more dignified and so that it really was what it was intended to be, which was a safety net, but work-oriented, but in a constructive way. Well, that wasn't this law. What was put on the president's desk after a lot of back and forth over the years 1995 and 96 was a law that said, instead of there being a right to assistance, which the previous federal law did provide, even though it was inadequate in so many ways, and even though states could set their benefits wherever they wanted, now the states could do whatever they wanted, have a program, not have a program, have a time limit of one day if they wanted, have whatever sanctions they wanted. And some states took up the invitation really with a vengeance after that. So that was one piece, the so-called block grant aspect of it, which said people, there's just no longer a right to get help. Mm-hmm. And the second piece was the time limit, 5 years. No matter what, in the course of a mom bringing up her kids, that's all she was entitled to be needing. Now, we're going to see as that plays out that there are women all over this country, families all over this country, that run into rough patches the way this economy is structured, and it's going to be for them more than 5 years during the bringing up of their children. But that was just arbitrary, and I thought that was also totally unacceptable. So it's those two things combined that were at the heart of why I said, you can't do this as Democrats and as decent people, and I can't stay here if this is the policy of our country.
We're talking this morning with Peter Edelman. He's professor of law at Georgetown University, long been involved at the federal level and at the state level in issues of poverty and welfare reform, a former legislative aide to Robert F. Kennedy. And he's held a wide variety of public service positions, and we're talking about poverty and welfare policy during this hour. We have one caller waiting. We'll talk with them and also welcome others if you'd like to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Southern Illinois on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
How are you doing?
Good.
I was born in 1973, and as far as I can remember, I was raised on welfare. My dad was in prison. My mother, she had no desire to go to work. I mean, now she's telling, before the election, she was saying, well, I don't want to vote for Bush because he's going to take away my Social Security. And I said, Mother, you've not even worked a day in your life. You don't deserve that Social Security, but yet they haven't taken it away, you know. But what I'm saying is, I've come out of that poverty level on my own with the desire to work, and as I was coming out of that poverty level, I've worked with many people in restaurants and everywhere else, and all of them just complain. Nobody's satisfied with what they have, and you know, if you're not content, then there's no desire to do any good. You know, there's nothing that pushes people out of bed to go. They want. You know, I call it the democratic mentality. Give me. You know, I'm raising a family of four with one on the way with $23,000 a year. I'm satisfied. My bills are paid. I'm content. I'm buying the house. My car's paid off. Everything. You know, I don't know if I'm really totally out of need, but I'm satisfied. And I work regardless if I'm tired or sick or whatever. But everybody I've ever worked with, nobody wants to work. They're all lazy. And that's my opinion, of course, and I guess it can change, but I've never seen anybody really attempt to change that. I'll hang out and see what you have to say, because the people you're talking about, there may be some legitimate ones out there, but there's no desire that I've noticed in all the my years of working. I've been working since I was 14 because I quit school in the seventh grade because my mother could not take care of me, but I still came out of that hole. And everybody else can, but they got to change their mentality and change the way they think, because nothing's free in this world. You got to work for it, but you can't waste your time on all the drugs and the junk that gets you off focus. And it's there, and I can prove it. I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call.
I have to say that's a lot of what the caller is saying is why a lot of us who are on the progressive side did not like the welfare system that we had in place. And so it may surprise him, but I agree in part with what he's saying. Now, I wonder where he lives, being able to make it as well, he says, on $23,000 a year, because there are immense differences in the cost of living if you're in a smaller community, in a place where housing costs are lower. It makes a tremendous difference. If you're in a large city and you're trying to survive on that kind of income with the number of children that he has, I think it's tough. But, you know, it's I would not paint with that broader brush. He's talking from his experience. I can't argue with that, of course. But it seems to me that most people really, really do want to work. And indeed, most people that I've talked to who have been on welfare or are on welfare would much prefer to be working. And I don't see the gimme kind of mentality. Obviously, it's out there on the part of some people. But I have to say that what we need to have in place, I think, if we're going to speak in generalizations that give us a kind of policy framework, is we need a policy that does push people to work without pushing them off the edge. That really does say to people, we're going to arrange the incentives and we're even going to maybe have some sanctions. But we're also going to recognize that there are some people, I don't know whether it's the caller's mother or it's somebody else, but there's some people who really have difficulty finding a job or are not in a position to work for one way or another. It's a delicate balance between pushing people, helping them keep the job when they get it, with all the extra kinds of things that for many people need to be there or they're not going to succeed, and having a safety net for kids in place. And, you know, I obviously admire a man who's done what he's done. That's really, really important.
When you first started working with Robert F. Kennedy and the two of you and the rest of the staff of RFK were addressing these issues, it as you recount in your book, work was central to his ideas about addressing poverty. But it wasn't just simply telling people that, you know, you had to change your ideas and start to go to work. It was an attempt to address the structural issues that kept people either locked in a personal pathology or in a, for example, in a central city where the jobs had essentially evaporated and there were no structural supports for people who, even if they wanted to work and were motivated to do so. But work was really central to his ideas about addressing it.
Absolutely central. He came to see, particularly as the years passed through his time as Attorney General and as Senator, that the heart of what we need to do is to stress jobs. And he believed, he saw at the time the chronic unemployment that there was even then in the inner city, and of course it was even more connected to racial discrimination then. And so he talked about if necessary, we needed to have some jobs that would be paid for with public money, but things that would enable people to succeed. And it's partly a matter of helping individuals, but also one of the great insights, I thought, was a lot of people live in places where the sense of community has really been destroyed, where they don't have the supports from their neighbors and from churches and others that are right there in the community, and that we needed to work on. The jargon would be place-oriented policies, but I really mean rebuilding neighborhoods and rebuilding a sense of community in neighborhoods, and that was a part of it. He was really, I think it's so interesting, Jack, he was really the first New Democrat. You know, it's become so popular now, Bill Clinton and talking about the third way and something that's not traditional liberalism and yet not conservative. And in my view, the kind of contemporary third way is an abdication of the public part of the responsibility. That was not Robert Kennedy. He said we needed to have public policy, national policy, but we also needed individual responsibility and community responsibility. We needed to have the business community involved. We needed to have the faith community involved. And so there was a three-dimensionality to his insight about how we move ahead with jobs at the center of it that we've lost.
You know, in reading the early part of your book where, you know, you're visiting Mississippi and some of these other places, it really strikes me that the notion that there were even poor people in America seemed so foreign to Washington that when you found people who were actually malnourished, people just didn't believe it.
Yes. Certainly at the beginning of the 1960s, when you think about what it was like in this country after World War II and the tremendous optimism that we had onward and upward, we had defeated the Axis powers, the Nazi Germany and all, and we could do anything. And so I think it was a shock to people. First, you had the civil rights movement where black Americans said, we're not going to live with apartheid anymore, and that forced itself on the national consciousness. And then you had books like Michael Harrington, The Other America, who came along and said, well, it isn't just a racial question. There are people of all races, all diverse backgrounds in this country who aren't making it. And Jack Kennedy went to West Virginia and campaigned in 1960 and was quite shocked by what he saw there of former miners who were unemployed, who were up in the hollows and in really desperate shape. And so there had been, while President Kennedy was in office and alive, Robert Kennedy had started working on these issues about poverty. He had a group of people working in his office very quietly. It started around the idea of juvenile delinquency, of how do we help young people who get into trouble or prevent that, but it really turned into how do we do something about poverty. And Robert Kennedy was really the leading public official in this country who was the driving force behind what became the War on Poverty, the Economic Opportunity Act. So that was all in the background when I went to work for Robert Kennedy in 1965 in the Senate. We already had something called a War on Poverty on the books. We were starting with programs like Head Start and community health centers and legal services for poor people and so on. What we did was essentially to go a step further, and it was my privilege to go with him, to go out there and see that even though we had said we had discovered poverty, we really hadn't, as a country, opened our eyes to see what was really out there. And there was a changing agricultural economy at the time in Mississippi, and the powers that be in Mississippi at the time wanted to push black people out because of the civil rights, which they regarded as agitation and very threatening. And so in 1967, in a country that was already quite wealthy, we went and saw children in Mississippi who turned out to be near starvation, with swollen bellies and sores that wouldn't heal, and doctors went on down and found exotic diseases like kwashiorkor and marasmus and rickets. And we did bring that to the attention of the country. And indeed, when we started to look at it, and George McGovern and others following Robert Kennedy's death kept on looking at it, it turned out that these were problems in too many places around this country. So Yes, we had started a war on poverty, but you know, we really didn't know the depth and extent of the problem until there was that incredible commitment that Kennedy had to go out and look and see for himself.
President Johnson, following the death of John F. Kennedy, if we look at the historical recollection of these days, it's said that he essentially took on that mantle, that he carried forward with the war on poverty and to a certain extent civil rights legislation in legacy of John F. Kennedy. In your book, you essentially fault Johnson for, yes, he did take certain steps and did some important things in the war on poverty, but he was only willing to go so far, that there was a certain point beyond which it was almost as if he were working against the greater effort.
I don't want to overstate that.
Okay.
I think Lyndon Johnson, well, I personally was deeply opposed to the war in Vietnam, and I think he bears enormous negative historic responsibility for that. He was the greatest president since Abraham Lincoln, anyway, that we ever had for civil rights in this country. You know, he went to Congress and gave a speech in which he said, "We shall overcome," and he meant it. So he was deeply committed to the enactment of those incredibly important laws, the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. He was also very concerned about poverty, but he was also concerned about keeping his budget in balance. And so when people came to him and said, "We want to do the war on poverty in 1964, Secretary of Labor Willard Wirtz said, "Well, you have to have a jobs program." And the historians recount that he literally pretended like he hadn't, in this cabinet meeting, like he hadn't heard Wirtz say that. So what they did was limited, but I don't want to be too 2020 hindsight about it. After all, they did Medicare and Medicaid. They did the first, this is the Great Society, not just the War on Poverty. They did the first federal aid to education that we ever had. I mean, these were huge historic initiatives. And so we don't want to be too tough on them. And then the war began to sap the resources that were needed to continue the investment. And so you got this competition and resources were drained away from really addressing the poverty questions. So I think the record is mixed there. But, yes, I do have that criticism. I would just put it in that kind of balance and framework.
Very good. We're a little past our midpoint here with Peter Adelman. He's professor of law at Georgetown University, a long time on the front lines of policy battles dealing with poverty and welfare policy. And we have about 20 minutes left in this hour to talk with him. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Last night you talked a bit about what happened after the 60s to what played out in the economy and what played out in people's attitudes about welfare. And certainly by the time 1980 rolled around with the election of Ronald Reagan, the country's attitude about the war on poverty and about welfare had certainly taken a turn for the worse.
Absolutely. I think we've had what I call the 30 years war on welfare that started in the late 1960s. And at the same time, a backlash about crime that was in part justified by maybe we weren't tough enough, but I think we've gotten to the point where we've really overdone it. And haven't focused enough on prevention and investment in children and so on that would prevent crime from taking place. So we've had this competition of two stories. We've had the one story that I want to say it was very racially tinged. People who were afraid to talk in overtly racial terms started to talk in terms of, well, we have to be tougher about crime and we have to do something about this awful welfare. And who were they? What was their image? Who were they talking about? We shouldn't kid ourselves. Their poster people, if you will, were people of color.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been the drumbeat for 30 years, is that these are the greatest problems of the society, and if we can just cut people off the welfare, make them stop being dependent, they will fend for themselves and everything will be fine. Well, the fact is that the story of the last 30 years is not that story. The right story is what's happened economically to the country, what's happened to the job market, why it is that we have so many lousy jobs in this country, what we were talking about before, the manufacturing jobs that went away and replaced by the lousy jobs, and millions of people in a difficult economic situation that we haven't responded to sufficiently with public policy. And so that's been the competing stories and the politics of the last 30 years. And I think that there has been an imbalance in our politics, unfortunately. That is to say, I think whatever you want to call it, the Democrats or the progressive side haven't held up their end of the bargain in really saying not just about poverty, not just about welfare. I'm talking about millions of people who got the short end of the stick. You know, this country is twice as wealthy in real terms as it was 20 years ago, but, you know, how many of the American people are twice as well off as they were 20 years ago? Very few. In percentage terms, very, very few. So that it's all stuck at the top. And so the politics has been the people who have been running, who, what should we say, represent the people at the top. I don't want to be too pejorative here. Have gone around saying, if you want to look, saying to the electorate, you want to look below you, not above you, as to where the problem is. And the problem is these people below you are collecting all this welfare, and if we can just stop that, you'll be fine. Well, that wasn't the right story. And there weren't enough people on the progressive side who said, wait a minute, there's a question of fairness that cuts across here. People have needs for health care. People have needs for child care. People have needs for housing. People have needs for better schooling for their children. People have the need to send their children to college, all of that. And we need to address that for a big, big chunk of American society. I don't think our politics has been what it should have been on all of those scores. And in many ways, the more conservative side has won the argument because they've done the politics more effectively.
Well, and they also have a simpler explanation for what's going on.
Absolutely, absolutely. Their story is very simple. Welfare, welfare, welfare. Our story is, well, you know, the economy went south. It was there are all those problems and problems developed in the inner cities for reasons that are complicated to explain, and on and on. And yes, there's simpler stories tend to win.
We have a couple calls to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. We'll go next to a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I look forward in reading your book and wanting to say hi from a mutual friend, Terry Langston from Washington. I wanted to ask you what you feel the solution to the healthcare system would be as another factor of helping to help solve the crisis that we're in. And I'll just hang up and listen.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for the call. Terry Langston's a good friend. I have two answers to that. One is, why in the world don't we have national health insurance? Why we are the only advanced industrialized or post-industrial country that doesn't have national health insurance. And so on a kind of simple level of principle, darn it, you know, why haven't we just done that? Well, it's complicated. You know, that's a trillion-dollar industry now. It's got a lot of political power. You move to a single-payer solution, as the jargon has it, and a lot of political power comes out of the woodwork to oppose it. It's changed. It isn't the American Medical Association anymore the way it was in the 50s and 60s and before that. It's now small business and the smaller insurance companies. So what we are consigned to, particularly after the fiasco of the Clinton health experience in 93 and 94 and how badly that was done, and then the fact that Clinton absolutely walked away from it after that, it's going to take us a while to get back, I think, to really being able to say, let's just cut through it. Maybe the managed care situation is going to get bad enough so that it'll sort of fall over of its own weight and we'll be able to make a more comprehensive change. In the meantime, we need to be talking about adding to what we have on the table. We have a good, although somewhat flawed, program of insurance for children that was enacted in 1997, the so-called SCHIP, or State Child Health Insurance Program. And that and Medicaid have gotten insurance coverage to children who previously didn't have it. But there are 7 million children who are currently around the country eligible among the 10 to 11 million uninsured children. 7 million children are actually eligible for either Medicaid or CHIP and haven't been signed up because they don't know about it or because bureaucratic restrictions and barriers get in the way, and we need to work on that. And I think we could get enacted this year if people would pull together about it. Getting, as a matter of national policy, parents covered as well, of the same income where we're covering the children. Parents have health needs, and one reason they're not signing up their children is because they themselves don't see it as being as much in their interest as they would if they had coverage as well. So we need full family coverage, and I think there's the possibility of getting that. I hope the Bush administration would support that.
We have a couple other people to talk with. Go next to a listener in Champaign County on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, I actually wouldn't mind if you'd elaborate on that some more. But what I wanted to get in was something you just touched upon, the idea that working poor and lower middle class people sort of identify up. And I think there are actually studies that show, you know, when a safety net goes away, that, you know, living wages go down for people just above that notch, just above that percentile, whatever. The other thing is I've heard Barbara Ehrenreich speak just recently about Wisconsin, and infant mortality has gone up in Milwaukee, and as you mentioned, there's no tracking of, not adequate tracking of people who are falling through. But her surmise is that if it was studied closely, that this would be linked to Wisconsin Works or whatever it's called up there. The other thing, I don't know if you want to do this, and you probably won't, but I'll throw it out, which is that I've heard that Clinton really had compunctions about signing this bill, the welfare so-called reform bill, and that even Robert Rubin was against signing it, and that it was actually Gore that sort of pushed him over the edge and said, we really need to politically sign this now, and we'll talk about fixing it later, which, again, pretty much I walked away from that, too. I'll hang up and listen to your report.
Can I just ask you before you hang up, when you say Clinton had compunctions, you mean he had reservations?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll talk about that.
All right.
Great. Thanks for the call.
Well, let's take it in reverse order, the question about Clinton. I don't think he had very real reservations about signing it. Now, I have to say I'm somebody who's pretty much pretty hard on Clinton, so you have to take that into account here. But I think Clinton is in a world of self-centered people, and you know, no elected official who's listening should be personally insulted. But people who run for office have ego. And in that world, Bill Clinton is the prize winner of all time. I mean, you know, he gives a new definition to narcissism. And so I just think that what was on his mind was his own survival above all, above everything else. So that he got advice on that occasion. You mentioned Robert Rubin. The advice that he received in the Oval Office at the dramatic meeting at the end of July 1996 was overwhelmingly to veto the legislation. And Robert Rubin, who is quite a wonderful man in social values, in addition to his financial acumen, Donna Shalala, Bob Reich, expectably. But most importantly, three political advisors, Leon Panetta, Harold Ickes, George Stephanopoulos, said to Bill Clinton at that meeting, veto the thing. You can survive politically. In fact, you'll get some credit for it. Clinton, to me, wasn't making a judgment based on 51 to 49 or 52 to 48. He was just saying, well, the thing, I'm not even going to take the chance that this becomes an issue that could possibly hurt me. I'm just going to go ahead and sign it. It's really important to understand that he never said that he would improve the welfare parts of the bill. What he said, and people didn't hear carefully, what he said after the bill was enacted is that he would fix the parts of the bill that related to immigrants. People forget that there were very, very harsh provisions in the bill that cut off SSI, supplemental security income, and which, you know, is disability, and food stamps to all legal immigrants, whether they were in the country already and all the ones that would come in the future. Just actually amazing. That would have been enough of an excuse for him to veto the legislation right there. That's what he said he would fix. He never said that he would fix the welfare parts of the bill. So that's on that. I've always thought that the fact that he received political advice, of course, Dick Morris, everybody remembers the Dick Morris, was telling him that for political reasons he should sign it. So that's the quality of the people giving the advice to sign it. Now, on the Wisconsin Works, Barbara Ehrenreich is right that we're beginning to see in Milwaukee some increases in issues about homelessness, child welfare protection, foster care issues, other kinds of the results of W-2 Wisconsin Works. And that's because, you know, the welfare rolls in Wisconsin are down by, depending on how you count, 80 to 90%. Yes, some people have gotten jobs, and of course they have 3% unemployment in Wisconsin, but they pushed a lot of people off the rolls, particularly in the early years of it when they were really trying to get people's attention that they were very, very serious. And those people are showing up with greater problems now, and that has not been publicized nationally. So she's right about that. His last point about the living wage, I don't know whether actually removing benefits causes wages to go down, but it certainly causes total income. And the problem is that we don't measure poverty correctly. $14,000 for a family of three, $17,000 for a family of four. Those numbers are just too low. Benefits cut off. If somebody gets a job that let's say at about $18,000, $19,000, $20,000. In most states, they lose their health coverage, they lose their food stamps, they lose any housing help that they got, and there are what we call in the jargon notches. So they actually end up worse off because they went out there and did what we wanted them to do. And so that's something that we need to take into account in this whole debate.
We have just about 5 or 6 minutes left and another caller, and I will certainly try to get them in. I just have to ask a question, though, about the tax cut proposal.
Yes.
Because this is something that is happening now that obviously it's a big deal, and I'd like to get your take on that.
It is a big deal, and I just am very troubled about this. I go around and do a lot of speaking, Jack, and so 3-4 weeks ago I was saying, well, the returns are not in. We'll see which way George W. Bush is going. Maybe he'll play to the center. Maybe he'll play to his base. Of course, we knew he was talking about the tax cut even then. But he's made all these John Ashcroft and other conservative appointments. He's made all these policy changes on the environment. I'm afraid we're beginning to see a pattern here. The tax cut itself is just deeply troubling. We're talking about not only a tax cut of a magnitude that will take away what the real surplus is, even assuming that it is that big with a recession coming, but it gives the vast majority of the benefits of that tax cut to the wealthiest people in this country. I mean, I don't understand why people aren't out in the streets saying, I'm about to get shafted here, because that's what's going to happen to 80% of the American people, is that they're going to take a literal hosing. 21% of the taxes are paid by the top 1%, yes, although some of us might say that they can afford it because that's people over $319,000 of income. 43% of the benefits of this tax cut are going to go to the top 1%. That's not right. When you add up to the 20%, you have 80% of the benefits that are going to go to the top 20%. That's not right. So we've got to get a debate going here that says tax cut of reasonable magnitude, pay down the debt, leave us some money to meet social needs in whatever area it is. The other thing that people, I guess, are not getting is that this is Reaganomics. This is destroying the federal revenue structure so that they can then come around next year and the year after and say, oh, golly, we'd like to have done these things, but we haven't got the federal revenue to do it. You know, it's like the person who killed his parents and went to court and defended himself because he's an orphan. The Senate just passed a budget resolution yesterday that begins to cut programs in order to make room for this tax cut. It's happening right now. That is wrong. Right now is a time when we actually have the ability to begin to meet some of these very pressing needs that we have as a society, and the question is whether we have the political will to do it. If we pass this tax cut in the way that it's been proposed, we're going to cut off our ability to do it. I think that's tragic.
We have a caller in just about maybe 2 or 3 minutes left. We'll squeeze him in. This is someone in Northern Illinois on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. I agree with you about Ronald Reagan, and still upsets me about the attitude that we have no responsibility, and it's not to our advantage to try to help people who are less fortunate. And I think Bush is following that. And there's tremendous discontent, not just like the first caller, people who aren't making a lot of money, but there are doctors complaining about contracts that only offer them $180,000, and they're all upset. You know, there are other doctors who are concerned about everybody's welfare. But my question is about unions. We're, for years and years and years, all the TV shows were about how terrible unions were and all of the ways they were cheating people. And I felt it leaked down to me where if I saw a product and there'd be a 5 cents difference, and if it was made in China rather than the United States, I'd go for the product that was only 5 cents a difference. And I look back and I think how stupid I was, because I think that destroyed a lot of the jobs. So would you comment on that?
I guess you're asking two questions. One is about trade, which I think we really, that's a tough thing to go into, the effects of NAFTA, and I'm basically a free trader, I have to say. But the other is about where we stand about unions in this country. And I think you have to separate out. We certainly had a lot of union bashing in the late 70s and early 80s, and we had lots of protections at the high end in manufacturing that were tough and made it harder for companies to make the adjustments that they needed to make. I don't think that's our situation now. The challenge, unions have become, I think, are a very important institution, but they've become a much smaller force in terms of how much of the labor force that they represent. I'd like to see, and I think John Sweeney, the head of the AFL-CIO, would like to see unions be much, much more aggressive about organizing among lower-income workers, among people who are having such a tough time making it, so that they could bargain with their employers and get a better wage that indeed that employer could afford. I think that's the cutting edge for unions in the year 2001, organize, and organizing particularly at the lower wage end of the labor market.
We're going to have to stop since we're here at the end of a time, and I'm sorry there's a caller that we won't be able to talk with. But I will suggest for folks that if you'd like to read more from our guest, you can look for his recent book, Searching for America's Heart, RFK and the Renewal of Hope, recently published by Houghton Mifflin. And our guest has been Peter Edelman, and his last name is spelled E-D-E-L-M-A-N, just so you can hopefully find it easy enough. And you also mentioned that there is a national organization. Do you want to plug the website or anything that you're involved in?
Oh, yes. Well, I hope people would check out the National Campaign for Jobs and Income Support, which is a group of grassroots organizations from around the country that are going to work hard to affect national policy on the very issues that we've been talking about this morning. And that website is www.nationalcampaign.org. And also the Children's Defense Fund, which my wife heads, is going to be introducing a bill to leave no child behind, which is a phrase that George Bush stole from her. It's the trademarked slogan of the Children's Defense Fund, and so now she's putting a bill where her slogan has been, and people should check that out. Children's Defense Fund is in Washington, D.C.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for being here. Great pleasure talking
with you. Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Jack.